Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Welcome to ModPath Chat, the official podcast of Modern Pathology, featuring interviews with authors and experts on the latest science, technology, and developments in the field of pathology. Your host, Dr. George Netto, is the editor-in-chief of Modern Pathology and the chair of pathology at the University of Alabama at Birmingham. Here's Dr. Netto.
Welcome to today's episode of ModPath Chat. This is the fourth and final episode of our special series covering this year's ASCAP long course on lung disease. I'm thrilled today to have with us Dr. Lynette Scholl, who served as one of the distinguished faculty on the long course. Dr. Scholl is an associate professor of pathology at Harvard Medical School. She's an associate pathologist at the Brigham and Women's Hospital, where she serves as chief of pulmonary pathology service and the associate director of the Center for Advanced Molecular Diagnostics, a mouthful. Thank you, Dr. Scholl, for accepting my invitation.
Oh, thanks, Dr. Netto, for the invitation. It's really thrilling to be here with you.
So, as you know, this is to try to cover the great talk that you gave about beyond PD-L for biomarkers of ICI in lung cancer. So clearly, we cannot, and we do not want to repeat the entire talk. The idea is just to tease the audience, so attract them to go and download the on-demand great talk that I really enjoyed attending. And also, we want to tell our audience that there will be an article published in the supplement issue on the long course by January next year, where you'll discuss all the details. So let's, among all these markers, let's start with TMB. What's the status? Is TMB dead in lung cancer, or you still use it?
Yeah, no, it's not dead yet, as Monty Python might say. Tumor mutational burden, which of course is what TMB stands for, is a really very fascinating biological variable. We see tremendous variation in the TMB from one cancer to the next when we sequence it on a daily basis. And that's true across different cancers, and that's true within lung cancer as well. So I think, again, as a biologic variable, it's really very cool. It's telling us something about the tumor that we really can't discern from looking at, say, any one individual genetic alteration. I think the problem comes in with actually implementing it as a practical biomarker in everyday clinical day-to-day life. The FDA has approved TMB as a predictive biomarker for pembrolizumab therapy, PD-1 inhibitor in particular, and that's actually a pan-cancer indication. So, regardless of what your diagnosis is, if you have a solid tumor and you have a TMB of, say, 11, and you've essentially exhausted your other available therapies for that particular cancer type, you can go and get pembrolizumab if you haven't received it already. So I think it offers a window of opportunity for patients who've maybe exhausted other traditional therapeutic options. And again, it's operating under the assumption that this tumor is making more than the usual number of mutations, and therefore is more likely to be generating neoantigens that are going hopefully to the surface of the tumor cell or getting picked up by the antigen presenting cells in the environment, and it's awakening your immune system. And mm-hmm. you add the pembrolizumab to it to really kind of bolster that immune response. Like that's sort of theoretically was supposed to happen here. I think the question really is like what is a TMB of 10, right? And that is where the approval sits in terms of what defines high. And I think there's a lot of debate in the scientific community and the laboratory community about really what defines a high TMB. Is 10 really high enough? And there's a lot of literature out there that would suggest that in many tumor types, it's actually a much higher cut point than 10. And, I think in terms of seeing a signal, for instance, in lung cancer, if you just rely on TMB alone as a predictor of response to immunotherapy, you're not going to see a very strong signal. But if you start to begin to push that TMB threshold up higher, you probably will start to see a more profound signal in terms of a prediction of response to immunotherapies. And then I think the question is, let's be honest here, the vast majority of patients who have a lung cancer diagnosis are already getting pembrolizumab in the first line. Maybe based on their PD-L1 score, if it's high, they'll be getting pembrolizumab alone, or they'll be getting pembrolizumab together with chemotherapy. So you don't really need a TMB for most lung cancer patients to get them that particular type of therapy. Are there patients, and in the talk, I gave an example of, say, lung cancer types where we don't usually think about giving pembro in the first line setting, such as atypical carcinoids. So maybe that's a scenario where you would start to think about it if you have a high TMB. I think the other scenario is, can you identify patients who have a higher likelihood of responding to immunotherapy, even though their PD-L1 score is, say, very low or negative? So can it help you to parse out those folks who, yet another variable that you can maybe identify those folks that you've been missing, maybe who are PD-L1 negative. So, I think as a complementary variable or complementary predictive biomarker, it holds some interesting promise.
We don't have time to go through the technical part of it and the variability, if you're what size of panel and all that, but that's another thing that I...
Yeah, that's a very important consideration as well.
So let's go to more topographic, or what you call in situ markers that you use. And basically it's counting CD8 positive cells or looking through IF with a spatial profiling, the idea of multiplexing and trying to see if that's, you think that's going to be in the future of added value?
Yeah, I think so. And I think, again, the devil's in the details with these things, right? Mm-hmm. Certainly, the better we understand the immune milieu, I think the better we're going to become at predicting which patients are likely to benefit from immunotherapy. It's so complicated, though, and I'm no immunologist, that I struggle to kind of wrap my brain around the complexity, of what we just see when we look down the scope, and trying to characterize these immune features. I think CD8 is certainly appealing because that's one of the effector cells that we need in order for pembrolizumab or for other, now approved immunotherapy drugs to actually work in our lung cancer patients. But it's becoming increasingly clear that that's probably not enough. As I discussed in the talk, it looks like CD4 cells are actually really important too in sort of orchestrating some of these responses. NK cells are important. There may be some evidence that the macrophages actually are better in, PD-L1 expression on macrophages is a better indicator of response, maybe even than expression on the tumor cells. I think capturing this information with a multiplexed approach, a more standardized multiplexed approach, recording it, benchmarking against lung cancer populations. I think the challenge we face now is like, what do you do? what is high CD8, right? Like, what number do you put on, or, you know, how many do you need to call it high? And all of us are probably operating with a different set of thresholds, and the same for all the other immune markers as well. It's not quite as straightforward as, is it brown or not, right? We actually have to quantitate these things. And what about the sample type? You know, what if all you have is a pleural fluid, or, you know, what if all you have is an FNA of a lymph node? You know, how do you apply this type of technology in that context? And so, you know, there's most certainly limitations to it. In our own institution, we're offering multiplex immunofluorescence testing largely as as part of a consented protocol, institutional protocol. So the patients will consent to this type of testing, and we'll run it and generate a report that the clinicians can actually view, and they're welcome to report the results back to the patients. Although at this point we have a limited ability to know how people will actually use that information, and I think, again, in terms of the technical challenges, right now our ability to multiplex is somewhat limited, right? So we're not able to capture every single different type of immune cell in the environment. Right. We're kind of limited to five or six markers.
So that's
what we do. So I think, you know, from the standpoint of standardizing our ability to quantify PD-L1, say on the tumor cells or on the immune cells, I think that a multiplexing approach and a multiplex immunofluorescence approach holds incredible promise, because I think we can only get better as far as I'm concerned at the way we're scoring these tumors. So the PD-L1 status, and I think this can help tremendously in that regard. And then we'll just have to see how much more information we can extract routinely from the standard clinical specimens that we get in practice for our lung cancer patients,
rather than eyeballing. So what you're talking about is adding the digital aspect. Yeah. You touch upon the good correlation between the digital computational counts versus eyeballing, and so that's probably would increase the inter-observer and the accuracy. I'm intrigued by what you mentioned, that you offer this test. So it's actionable for the clinicians, or you're just at the phase of collecting data?
Well, you know, it's sort of interestingly straddles this this sort of research and clinical type of assay, because, you know, really the minute you put this information back into the clinician's hands, you can't stop them from acting on it. And, you know, I think, again, it's just very much informational, because they already probably got a PD-L1 IHC stain on their lung cancer patients, because we do that reflexively for everybody. You know, to some extent, we open ourselves up to additional criticism, right? Because they've already gotten a quote unquote brown stain IHC for PD-L1, and then we're going to generate a separate multiplex immunofluorescence result, which may be slightly different than what was seen on IHC. We've had a couple of these scenarios where, you know, maybe one was PD-L1 low and one was PD-L1 high, and we have to figure out how to address that. And part of that can be driven by the fact that you tested a different block, or you tested a different spec, you know, obvious things like that. Sometimes it's because, and I mentioned this in my talk as well, it can be utilizing a scoring of the entire slide versus scoring just regions of interest. And again, I mentioned in my talk that there's very practical limitations to implementing multiplex immunofluorescence that relate just to computational power. So you got to find a place to store these images, and a whole slide image that is a six-plex immunofluorescence, that's a pretty massive image. So this is hospital infrastructure. This is big kind of computational infrastructure that you need to invest in order to support this type of work. You don't really need that for a brown stain, because you just stick it in a file. So you need a drawer, right? A little different.
But it's definitely some exciting potential for growth and finding better quantitation. So hopefully that will work out.
Yeah.
Let's finish then. We have time probably to talk about one of the genomic markers that probably can come in play also as a biomarker here. Do you want to share?
Yeah, sure. I think, you know, I guess I would just mention, I think STK11, because I think it's sort of the trendy genomic predictor that you hear about. You often hear your clinician colleagues talking about, oh, what's their STK11 status? Maybe they won't respond to immunotherapy because they've got this STK11 mutation. So, you know, the kind of the backstory on that is that patients who are smokers and have lung cancers, in particular adenocarcinomas, have a pretty high rate of STK11 mutations. And I have to say off the top of my head, I think it's probably somewhere on the order of 15 or 20% of the time in that kind of clinical context, you're going to find an STK11 mutation. And they're very, very high sort of likelihood of being loss of function mutations. And that's, they may be premature truncating mutations, or they may be a missense mutation that affects the function. Has a tumor for suppressor function. So if you have a truncating mutation, that manifests as loss of protein by IHC. So that's something we can easily study using routine clinical IHC analytes. So it's information that we can generate without too much trouble. And again, it's fairly common in lung cancer patients. And what we've seen from a number of largely retrospective studies is that the loss of STK11 expression seems to predict a relatively poor response to immunotherapy. And that's both immunotherapy, monotherapy, as well as in combination with chemotherapy. There have been a couple of efforts, I think, to begin to confirm that in prospective clinical trials. And they haven't really panned out, / they haven't really been published yet. So I think we'll probably continue to see this space evolve. Right now, you know, and we've had conversations, well, should we be routinely doing STK11 IHC in patients for whom they're thinking about doing immunotherapy? And we've never really bitten the bullet and done that, in part because we do offer next gen testing in house that will generate the STK11 mutational status.
Got the answer there.
And I think in part, you know, these patients are going to get immunotherapy anyway, right? What is the alternative? You could give them chemo alone, but unless the STK11 mutation actually predicts they're going to do worse, like than would with chemo alone, I think it makes it hard. It's not a strong enough negative predictor to actually, I think, force people away from giving immunotherapy in the first line setting, you know, again, with or without chemotherapy. So I think it's important to be aware of it as a potential predictive biomarker. It's something that comes up in tumor board conversations, not infrequently, but I think at this point, it's not actually changing the way the medical oncologists are choosing to start therapy.
Well, hopefully it'll be other markers. I know you mentioned KEAP1 and others. So this is fascinating. And I encourage everyone to go and listen to the entire talk. You'll learn even more. It's been a pleasure. And thank you, by the way, for all the help you offer us for the journal in terms of contributing your articles and helping reviews, and I look forward to the article and the supplement on your talk. It's been a pleasure to have you.
Well, thank you for all your support, and it's been wonderful to talk to you today.
Thank you.
Any opinions expressed in this podcast are the speaker's own and do not represent the views of Modern Pathology, Springer Nature, UAB, or USCAP. Your ModPath chat host and scientific director is Dr. George Netto. Producers are Christina Crow, Amber Jackson, Dr. Sarah Jang, and Dr. Catherine Ketchum. Technical direction is provided by Kaminsky Productions, music by Mitch Neubauer. Thanks to the authors, reviewers, and editors of Modern Pathology for making this podcast possible.